online, on digital, and the ABC Listen app. The Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Coming up today, no relief in sight for Tasmanian farmers as the big dry continues.
Right through summer, we've had probably one of our warmest summers day in, day out for a long time. And just looking at the soil dryness index and the forecast, it's just shown Tasmania's been pretty dry all round.
And don't hold your breath waiting for lower prices on olive oil.
Europe's had another fairly ordinary year, and I think the demand is increasing year on year because people realise how good of a product is, especially this cold climate olive oil. Well, this year we haven't been able to keep up with it. We're getting down in our stockpile now, way down. So the sooner we start harvesting, the quicker we'll have oil.
Yeah, the latest olive harvest at Tasmania's biggest grove, and it looks like a bumper crop. But that may not mirror any future price drop for the precious cool climate oil. We'll take you to that grove a little bit later in the program. G'day, Tony Briscoe with you on this Thursday, where we also visit a couple of farms to check the latest as the big dry continues across the state. And on King and Flinders Islands especially, where once again it's extremely dry, we'll check in with the Bureau at the halfway stage and we'll get the details about the Maria Island wave rider buoy on the east coast. Some big news coming up for that. Also today, some information for farmers on private lending available to help purchase properties instead of the usual bank lending. You too can join in the program via that text line. 0438 922 936 is that number. 0438 922 936. Well, to the untrained eye, the paddocks around the Oatlands area look green but scratch the surface and there's very little moisture in the soil. Tasmania has just experienced its driest April in a decade, the Bureau of Meteorology says. And sheep and cropping farmer Maria Weeding chatted to reporter Meg Whitfield about the big dry.
It's been pretty dry, really, right from spring. It was only a fairly ordinary spring. We had a lot of wind in spring, actually, which dried the ground out, so we didn't have a fantastic spring. And then right through summer, we've had probably one of our warmest summers day in, day out for a long time. And just looking at the soil dryness index and the forecasts across Australia, you can sort of find in some of the rural newspapers, it's just shown Tasmania's been pretty dry all round. So we're just looking for the skies for another patch of rain to fall down, but it's not happening at this point, and it's... Yeah, the soil's very dry, even though it's still green, so to look at in terms of, you know, grass around. But, it's not really growing at this point.
How much are you having to rely on irrigation rather than rainfall?
Look, we've got a reasonable amount of irrigation that we can do on the property from the Midlands Water Scheme. Yeah, so we do grow crops, and that's been absolutely fantastic. We've been able to, you know, succeed in getting these crops grown and off and everything. Yeah, we're sort of also relying on some of those circles that we've got now for feeding sheep. And we've also got quite a bit of hay and grain in storage as well as a result of being able to actually grow these, you know, grow some of the grain crops. You know, we've stored a lot of grain as well, just in preparation, because it did look like it was going to be a bit of a dry patch coming up.
Over the years, we have seen, or in recent years, we have seen quite a few very dry summers and places like King Island being driest on record, things like that. How much preparation do you undertake now, just preparing for the fact that this might be a common story going forwards?
Look, I think these days, and I'm sort of observe what other farmers are doing as well. I think a lot of people are starting to, you know, come with a common practice of starting, you know, you store a bit of food just for the next season that might fail, such as an autumn or a spring. So certainly here we've always got grain or some hay in storage or anything like that in case we feed lot sheep and things like that. And I think people are starting to do that now as a matter of course, because you just can't rely on the seasons being as you might like them to be, put it that way. So we, you know, we are prepared if we do need to feed our stock right through. We've kept a lot more grain this year and more than we would normally. And it's not great though. I mean, it's always better if you don't have to feed feed animals.
And I imagine that's a significant expense then on your behalf as well, having to prepare additional for that just-in-case situation. Yeah.
Yes, that's right. Well, it's just, I mean, it's just income that you actually haven't realised. I mean, you've actually grown a product, but then you, you're literally storing it. So, rather than selling it and getting a bit of extra income in on the farm. But I think at the end of the day, it's just insurance for, in case you get a bad season. And I think a lot of people are starting to farm in those sort of ways as well, so that they are prepared, ready for a bit of a dry spell if it comes along. And we seem to be seeing them fairly frequently in the last, well, probably 10 years or more, I'd say, 10 or 15 years, yeah.
And what conversations are you having with other farmers around the Oatlands area at the moment? Are others feeling nervous? Are they feeling prepared? What's the sense on the ground?
Few that I've asked have all said that they're feeding, so I think, well, okay, that's good. They must have some food that they've actually either stored up or they've got themselves prepared. So I think everybody's now in the mind, well, from what I'm hearing, a lot of people are in the mindset that they are going to have to be feeding quite extensively over this winter period, and hoping obviously that we do get a spring. So that's good, but everyone's just saying they wish it would rain, because it would. We really do need the rain. And look, end of May is really stretching it. We've had some couple of very cold frosts here in the last week or so. It's really put a dampener on anything trying to grow. So I don't know whether we'll get a lot of effective growth from here on in. Certainly once you get to June, it's pretty much all over. It's just... look, if you're driving through, it looks green still. So to the untrained eye or people that don't follow soil dryness and things like that as much, it looks like everything's fine. But it really is very dry once you start to dig up the ground. So there's not a lot of resilience at this stage for the plants to grow, or the grass to grow, I should say.
Sheep and cropping farmer Marie Weeding talking there to Meg Whitfield from her farm in the Oatlands area. Well, David Munday is a fencing contractor based on King Island. He told Meg Whitfield the community was hoping for a wet winter but preparing for a repeat of last year's record tough conditions.
Well, the ramifications from the previous year are showing out this year. It's got dry again. The last, I think since January, the last 4 months, we've had 50 mils of rain, which is unusual for the island just for 4 months, so it's dry. But we're not as bad as the following year. We had a better spring last year, so people cut fodder and were more prepared. But water is obviously becoming a real issue now on the island. If we don't have a wet winter, I think there'll be a lot of people who will be in trouble with water.
And how is it looking on the island at the moment? Are there still patches of green, or is it really drying out to the naked eye?
No, there's areas. The southern end of the island probably gets a little bit more rainfall than the north end of the island, in the vicinity of 10 to 20 inches in the old imperial system. And so the bottom end of the island is probably a lot greener than the top end of the island. So it's not as bad down this way, is the way to say it.
And you put up some video recently of pear-shaped lagoon. Can you talk to me a bit about what the water levels are looking like there at the moment?
Well, it's still low. There's nothing in it. And last year it didn't run over the spillway. It was about a metre in height of water, not to run over the spillway. So it was duressed from last year. And then this year, because we've had such a dry spell from sort of November, December onwards and right through to the end of April, it's showing the duress of being nearly dried up.
What kind of a toll is that taking on the community at the moment?
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously people, I can't speak for anybody, but, I mean, there's obviously pressure. And as I said, the point around talking to a lot of people, if we don't have a wet winter this winter, and we're already, not only 2 weeks off winter, we as an island will be in a lot of trouble with regards to water storage on farms. And maybe even the water supply for the island itself through Taswater.
What kind of steps are people taking to try and provide a bit of a buffer or prepare for those circumstances?
Well, it's the first time in my life, and I've lived here for nearly 60 years, that I've seen a water tanker delivering water to some dams and tanks like for stock. And I never thought I'd ever see that on the island, but that's happening on a regular basis. And the water for people for their houses has been dramatic, people running out of water for their houses. So it has been fairly, you know, eye-opening to see it happen.
Mm. You mentioned it was a pretty good spring that we just had, particularly coming off the back of what had been a really tough summer. Has that provided a bit of a buffer for people, or is that water already gone, given there hasn't been much rainfall to keep those supplies up high?
Well, Pear-shaped Lagoon is a perfect example of that. We had a good spring. I mean, we had a very dry winter. The island didn't... what's the best way to say it? There was a chap I asked last year about September, October, how he got in the winter, and he said it was the best winter he'd ever had. And I looked at him and said, what do you mean by that? He said, well, I had no mud. He had no mud on his property. So he's saying that it was such a dry winter last year, and it's looking the same way by modelling that everybody talks about here on the island, that it's looking the same way. And so it just makes it more dramatic of you know, the ramifications of it all.
Mm. And are people trying to, you mentioned getting dams filled, getting water carters, things like that, are people trying to get ahead of it now, or is it just playing catch-up?
No, they are. The excavating businesses on the island are fairly busy doing, you know, cleaning out dams and trying to make water storage more for when the rain does come. But those dams were already duressed from last year. Again, like the lagoon, a lot of dams on this island would not have filled up last year. So then they're under pressure straight away with evaporation and getting, you know, warmer. And that's why the lagoon down there is dried up, because it's only a shallow body of water, but it probably holds 5 to 10 million litres of water, but because it's got down, it's dried out from evaporation.
Mm. And what steps are being taken just to kind of protect the community at the moment? I imagine this is something that a lot of people are feeling. Are people looking out for each other and trying to lend a helping hand where they can, just to check in on their neighbours?
Yeah, I'm sure they do. You know, like, we're like, in a sense, one big family here on the island. We all sort of know one another. And, of course, we do a Rural Alive and Well. We're just on the island recently and ran a workshop. And so, but as I said to my friends, you don't know who is under pressure and how they respond to that pressure, Meg. So it's never easy to do it that way. And you don't want to be in people's faces either. Mm. and make it worse, if you know what I mean. Like, if our paper was to run a story on the dryness on the island every week or every once a month, I mean, that would get the people. And so you've got to be tactful how you go about things. So, yeah, we all look after one another, or we'll try to.
Mm, absolutely. Is there anything else you think is important to note here, any steps that you think need to be taken to look after the community at the moment, whether that's, would you support water restrictions? Do you want to see more feed coming over? What kind of needs to be done here, or is it a wait-and-see situation?
I think it's a wait and see, but I think the main point that I would think is, as I said, we need a wet winter. Mm. And if we don't get a wet winter, I may be talking to this time next year and saying it's a lot worse. So, you know, as most people say to me, we need a wet winter, and there's no getting away from that. And the same as mainland Tasmania, South Australia, the Western districts of Victoria are in the same boat. I mean, they're probably worse than us here on the island. I don't know the exact situation in Tasmania, but I imagine if we're dry, we have the same weather pattern that causes rain for Tasmania. And so I'd imagine Tasmania, the mainland part of Tasmania, is exactly the same as us here, is a bit duress with it all.
Yeah, David Munday, fencing contractor on King Island, talking there to Meg Whitfield about the dry conditions on the island at the moment. We'll check the latest on the weather in about 15 minutes from now, but in a moment we'll talk about private lending for the farming community.
Breakfast with Rick Goddard.
Have your radio turned on just before 8 o'clock as we find out who will be winning the trip to see Spicks and Specks filmed live.
Rick Goddard.
Back tomorrow from 5:30 a.m.
on 936 ABC Radio Hobart. It's the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
The Reserve Bank is widely predicted to make another interest rate cut when the board meets next Tuesday. Good news for anyone with a mortgage. But it's not just the big banks loaning the capital to purchase something like a farm. Larissa Smith spoke to finance broker Charlie Kramer about some of the changing trends in the private lending market.
there's more opportunity for farmers to seek more solutions in the market than there used to be. So it's, again, I'll say it again, it's a market-driven kind of product. It is growing. It's not growing massively. In the US, I think it's probably, I think it was $1.6 trillion worth of non-bank lending in the US. We're about $188 billion. We are probably, it might only be, you know, a very small percentile of the lending market that would be non-bank, whereas in the US and European markets, it's the other way around. So certainly there's a lot of growth.
Why is the case? What's the comparison there?
A lot of the normal traditional lending through banks has not necessarily slowed down, but it's got a little bit more difficult for all players because of the way it's regulated. There's also a market expectation for investors in banks that the banks will take a certain amount of risk. The market is asking finance to take a larger amount of risk, and that's where the private money comes in.
And when you talk about private money, what are those channels? Where are those avenues?
So they would reach from, you know, I think Northern American pension funds or super funds. Then the next level would be institutions such as normal super funds here in Australia, all the way to family offices, to large businesses, and then to almost mum and dad investors that are pooling their money together to put a small fund together and to lend out. Private lending, generally, it's a transactional style product, meaning that it's going to start date and end date. So 2 years is probably the maximum that it's going to be. And it's used to take advantage of an opportunity. So there's a business that wants to buy another business that is underperforming. It can put money into that, it turn the business around, and then refinance into another, you know, a normal bank. That's how it would work. And the interest piece, it is relevant, but it becomes one of the costs of doing business. So it's you would look at, it might cost me $200,000 to make this transaction happen. That works in my feasibility. I'll go ahead and do it. Whereas with a normal bank that you might consider over 30 years or 25 years, the rate is relevant because you're paying it for so long. And you would pay more. You know, if you borrow $1 million, you'd pay $1 million in interest for your home loan. For private lending, you actually pay much less, but it's a bigger number because it's a short term.
So do you think that private lenders feel they are more comfortable taking on higher risk than the banks are?
Comfort is...
Should I use a different word?
No, it's a common word to be used in credit. And it's usually driven by, you know, in old banking terms, it's driven by the treasury settings, as in this is how much money we've got, this is how much money we have to make. And then they would dial up the risk needle or dial it down. With private investing, the people who are, you know, putting the money into the funds are expecting a return above what a bank would return. And so there is a higher level of risk. Certainly the lenders look to cover off every kind of risk that they don't want to, you know, be exposed to. But absolutely, they do look at higher risk, and that's the nature, and that's what you pay more for. You know, where there's opportunity, there's peril.
And are there certain industries that are leaning towards more private lending?
Yeah, there are. And private lending is absolutely more commercial than it is for, you know, your mums and dads. The businesses generally that are at the forefront would be your property developers. And that could be rural property developers, as in we're buying farms and refixing their capacity. Or it could be blocks of flats in the city. It could be anything. And why that works for the private lending in Australia is because it is, again, we know there's a start date and a finish date. We have a plan, and we know that we're going to be in and out within a certain amount of time. So the cost of finance is something that's measurable at the beginning of the project and can be calculated in. So they're usually the businesses that we see most. We are seeing a little bit of large to middle, sort of almost mid-market, and I'm talking about borrowings of sort of between 50 and 200 that are coming in from overseas, from large, might be pension funds from the US as well. They are cheaper, but they're still a little bit more expensive. I've seen one that's cheaper than a bank, but not many.
Are they looking for projects or investment in for sustainability reasons too? Is that attached to that contract?
It absolutely can be. So depending on the fund and the fund settings, it 100% is. So there'll be, you know, some lenders aren't interested, like Westpac, for instance, is not interested in oil. So there will be funds that are interested in, you know, high ESG businesses. There'll be ones that don't care. And I guess it really depends on the mandate of the shareholders in the fund. So yes, is the short answer to that.
What's the attraction for private lenders in Tasmania, in Tasmanian agriculture?
I am not a private lender. I work with private lenders. What I do know about Tasmania is it produces so much per hectare as against the rest of Australia. So the customers that I work with in Tasmania, they have incredible output for the amount of land that they've got. And the value of the land, particularly rural land, just stays solid and goes straight up, and it continues to go up. The weather works really well in Tasmania. We were talking a little while ago about, a once-in-a-99-year drought, which actually was one in 99 years. That's incredibly rare for Australia. So I don't see the lending market going backwards for Tas. If anything, I see more investment in Tasmania.
That's Charlie Kramer, head of agribusiness with finance brokering firm Agfin, talking to Larissa Smith about private lending. Well, Susan Lee made headlines around the country this week as the first woman to lead the Federal Liberal Party in its more than 80-year history. But the new opposition leader also has a big history in agriculture, and especially the shearing industry. Susan Lee was once a roustabout and shearer's cook. Warwick Long spoke to Rob Crouch, who runs A-Team Shearing Contractors near Geelong in Victoria, to find out more.
Well, yeah, it sure does. It's one of those things, when you get into politics and all that, you just, if someone's, grassroots, you know, it comes back to the agriculture, sheep industry, cattle industry, or, you know, shearing industry, it's a good thing, and you hope it holds well.
But when we say roustabout, what's a rousey do in the shearing shed?
Yeah, well, they've probably the most undervalued position in the shed at the end of the day. The shearer's always in the spotlight, but we shear the sheep for the wool, and, you know, they play the biggest part in preparation. If your wool clip's not prepped right, it can have a huge impact on the check. So rouseabouts are, you know, they've got to keep the floor clean, they've got to keep the board organised, they've got to get the wool up onto the table in a certain manner. The wool's got to be prepped for the classer. They hold a really, really big role in the wool shed, and I believe they're extremely undervalued.
But always working, keeping the team together.
Keeping the team together. Yep, we don't have roustabouts as shearers. Well, the show can't go on.
And shearers cooks. Is there a big difference between the good and the bad in that world?
Yeah, there sure is. Yep. You get up. Get up in the far west of New South Wales or something, you're stuck out there for a couple of months with a bad cook. And as a contractor, it can create some very big headaches. So we're very lucky. Last year we had my wife and my sister up there, cooking for the boys and the girls. And, a good cook, it starts the day and finishes the day very well.
Politics aside, do you have any insight or any idea what Susan Lee would be like as a shearer's cook?
I don't know if I should comment. No, I'm sure she's done a wonderful job. Would probably hear about it pretty soon if she didn't.
And do you think that there are any skills that shearers, cooks, or roustabouts that you've been around over your years have learned? Do you think there are skills there that Susan Lee can lean on?
Oh, well, look, yeah, she's would have dealt with all walks of life, and I'm sure she's going to get that with politics as well.
And so when it comes to shearing, what is it about your industry, Rob? Because the Labor Party, the Australian Labor Party, proudly talks about its roots and the start of its party coming from shearers and under the knowledge tree in Buck Alden in Queensland. It proudly says its roots are with shearing. You've got now the leader of the Liberal Party all over a century, nearly a century and a half later, talking about her roots working as a roustabout and a shearer's cook. What is it about shearing and politics?
Well, I think just the shearing industry in general, it's been such a big part in Australia's history. And I think we all relate to it one way or another.
So it's almost part of the fabric of Australia.
It is, yeah. Yeah.
Well, how's the industry going at the moment, Rob? It was a real struggle for shearers during COVID and some of the boom years for sheep recently, but it seems that's cooled, yeah?
Oh, it's just, yeah, it's unreal how it just gets flipped on its head so quickly. We're just so dire for staff there, for the last 3 years. And put so much effort into, you know, getting the skill set behind people to hop into it quite quickly. And now we're turning young people away. You know, we're just staff. Like, we're just letting staff go every week now, and it's really hard to see, actually.
So you're having to let staff go because there's not enough work?
Yeah, yep. We're generally very busy all the way through May. You could nearly say we've come to a grinding halt. We've got, you know, we've still got teams out, you know, some local teams just chipping away. But, it's just changed just dramatically. And, you know, we've got really big clients that, you know, their sheep numbers never, ever alter. And, you know, some of them places their sheep numbers have halved.
And is that hard, yeah, given, I think, because there was such a pressure in the industry for so long to get new workers? A lot of people would have been enticed into shearing, thinking it was going to be, there was always going to be work and always a lot of money to be made.
Yeah, well, that's how we were advertising it, weren't we? But we certainly believe that. Like, we've just the terrible year we've just walked into now. Like, it's the water situation. We all can handle feeding sheep, but when you've got to start running water, it just creates a whole new dynamic, a whole new stress on the farm, and you know, then you just run into panic selling. And but yeah, what do you do?
So it's the big dry that's really led to the cool off in demand for shearing.
Yeah, yep, and that and the live export in WA, we're just really starting to notice. Like, my phone, we're just really noticing that. I think the guys are coming to terms with it. I think the industry as a whole over there is going to be, you know, I don't know, yeah, why you run sheep over there if you sort of lost that live export. Like, the domestic market's, you know, pretty tough over there. And we're really starting to notice a lot of people wanting to come over, but there's not the room over here. It's just a lot of things all at once.
Yeah, that's Rob Crouch from A-Team Shearing Contractors talking to Warwick Long about the new Liber of the Liberal Party, Susan Lee, who once was a roustabout and shearer's cook. And also talking about the lack of work for shearers at the moment. Still to come on the Country Hour, the latest olive harvest at Tasmania's biggest grove. We celebrate Alpaca Week, and we meet the very good Australian stock horse, plus a check on the weather. First up, the news headlines with Loretta Loberger.
Good afternoon, Tony. TAS Networks Chief Executive Sean McGoldrick says communication systems within the state-owned power company have not been up to standard. The state government yesterday released the final report of a review into last August's storms that left 47,000 Tasmanians without power for several days. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has acknowledged countries such as Russia are attempting to increase their influence in the Indo-Pacific region. Mr. Albanese will today meet with his Indonesian counterpart Prabowo Subianto today as part of his first international trip since being re-elected. Israel has issued one of the most sweeping evacuation orders for civilians in Gaza yet seen in its war against Hamas. Large swathes of Gaza City have been declared unsafe, with residents told to leave ahead of intense strikes. And Australia's unemployment rate held steady in April as 89,000 people found employment. The figures reveal much stronger jobs growth than had been forecast. The unemployment rate remained at 4.1% last month, the same level as in March in seasonally adjusted terms. More news at 1 o'clock.
Time now to check the latest on the weather and to find out what's happening. Ellie Matthews joins us from the Bureau. G'day, Ellie.
Afternoon, Tony.
Well, it certainly was a cool start overnight, especially in some areas down in the minuses.
Yeah, we did see -1 recorded as a minimum temperature at Cressy, Fingal and Ross. So we did see some frost through parts of the northern Midlands in particular and into that Fingal Valley there. And I suppose that is a little insight as to what we are expecting in the coming days. So whilst the rainfall forecast is relatively dry, what we will be seeing over the coming days is going to be quite the cold snap over Tasmania. So whilst we've got a relatively light to moderate westerly flow over the state at the moment, meaning showers in the west, it's remaining dry elsewhere until we head into tomorrow afternoon, where we will have a frontal system moving over from the southwest of us. And that's going to bring a significantly colder air mass over us, particularly on Saturday and into Sunday. So with that front, we might see some showers extending into parts of the south and northeast, maybe even the coastal parts of the east. But in terms of rainfall totals with those, we're merely only going to see a few millimetres across the weekend. What will be more significant is those temperature drops. So in the coming 2 days, whilst we're looking at maximum temperatures in the mid to high teens with just some isolated areas of morning frost into tomorrow morning, by the time we get into the weekend, we're going to be looking at widespread frost, particularly Sunday morning, and maximum temperatures really only just making it into the low teens for Saturday and Sunday, Tony.
Taste of winter coming up.
Yes, that definitely is what we are in for the weekend. Could even see some snow flurries to around 500 metres, particularly about more southern parts of the state.
Now, nothing in the gauges anywhere?
Oh, in terms of what we've seen in the last 24 hours, it's only really been about the most western of sites that we've seen anything, potentially maybe a fraction of a millimetre about some southern locations as we had some showers move over during yesterday morning, but really not much.
Now, after the weekend, what can we expect then?
Yeah, so once we get through the coldest of the weather, we do have a ridge of high pressure that's going to move over us into early next week. And what that will mean is continued settled conditions, but it will maintain that colder air over the state. So we will be seeing continued inland frost, particularly Monday and Tuesday, and really the rainfall forecast is continuing dry, really even into the middle of next week.
What are the temperatures like at the moment, Ellie?
Looking at temperatures at the moment across the state, we're generally looking at things sitting around sort of the mid-teens. If I were to talk to the temperature in Launceston, we're sitting at about 17 degrees at the moment. Similar down in Hobart, it's through more inland parts, it's a little bit cooler. So through your Cressy, Ross, about the 15 to 13 sort of degrees. It's into the west where we're seeing those onshore winds that is keeping temperatures down around sort of 13 degrees or so.
Now, warnings.
Yes, so for today, we do currently have a strong wind warning for southern coastal waters from Tasman Island to Low Rocky Point. Now, into tomorrow, we will see that extend to southern and western coastal waters from Tasman Island to Sandy Cape.
And looking at the coastal waters and swell.
Yeah, so today we've got west to northwesterly winds of 15 to 25 knots. They're reaching up to 30 knots about the south. Those winds continue into tomorrow until they begin to tend west to southwesterly 15 to 25 knots about the south and west during tomorrow afternoon. And we will gradually see those southwesterly winds extending elsewhere by late Friday evening. Now, with the swells in the west and south today, we've got a southwesterly of 2.5 to 3.5 metres. And into tomorrow, we'll start to see that build to 3 to 5 metres and even further later tomorrow evening to about 5 to 6 metres, particularly about the south. With the swell through Bass Strait, it's westerly to 1 metre, building to 1.5 metres tomorrow. Whilst in the east, we've got a southerly of around 1 metre today. That's going to build up to 2 metres tomorrow.
Now, Ellie, before we do the wave rider, I've got to do this. Big drum roll, because
we finally have the Mariah Island Wave Rider Boy.
Oh, yes.
Up and running.
Great. What's it reading?
Currently sitting at around 1.5 metres from a southerly direction. It's wonderful to have that one back up and running now, Tony.
And the other one?
Cape Sorrel, currently sitting at 3.1 metres from a southwesterly direction.
So that was a long, prolonged process, wasn't it, getting the boy back in the water?
Yeah, making sure that one was refurbished and ready to be redeployed was a process. It's been out since about June last year, so it's nearly been 12 months.
Oh, just say boy, oh boy.
Exactly that, Tony.
Thanks, Ellie.
Cheers.
Good on you. Ellie Matthews with the latest information for you on the weather there and the news that the Wave Rider Boy at Mariah Island is back in the water. Coming up in just a moment, the olive harvest.
Time for footy on Analog Radio tonight. Let ABC Sport get your ears in the action. AFL Round 10, Gold Coast, play Hawthorn. Or you can hang out with me, Helen Shield, at 6:45 on the ABC Listen app or on digital from 936 ABC Radio Hobart.
On air, online, on digital, and the ABC Listen app. This is the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
It's harvest time at Tasmania's largest olive grove just outside Campania in the Coal River Valley. And according to Chris Dick, the manager of Tasmanian olive groves, the harvest this time around should be much better than last year. But he says there probably won't be an easing on the price of oil for consumers in the short term.
It should be a good crop because there's a fair volume on the trees.
Okay, so it's one of those good years.
Yes, it's the on year, as I call it.
How do you know when they're ready?
Just by squeezing them, seeing the water and oil content come out of them and pulling them off with a pullometer to see how much pressure's on them.
A pullometer.
Well, that's what I call it. But
yeah. Describe it. What do you do with it?
Oh, it's just a spring with a pressure dial on it. So you put a fork around the olive and pull it and it gives you the pressure at which the olive releases from the tree.
So it needs to be in that zone before
Yeah, in a certain zone as a guide. Yeah. Not only that, but just as the ripeness of the fruit.
Now, what are you using to harvest with this year? The monster machine?
The Sigma shaker, yes.
How's it going, or is it going not?
Oh, no, it's going. It's just one little repair to be done, and that'll be done. We'll be away.
Okay. How long will harvest be this year?
10 weeks, I imagine, with a break in between, waiting for other varieties to ripen.
Okay. How many different varieties?
10-ish.
So there's early starters and late starters.
Yeah.
There's some that won't be harvested for another couple of months.
Yeah, some won't be harvested till June. Depends on what the weather does. Rain, wind, frost.
Doesn't rain. Come on. I know it looks like it's raining, but it's not really at the moment.
It's mist here. It's gone all around this morning.
What's it been like?
Very dry. But February, March on the rain chart shows that it was average, but it didn't seem that at the stage because it was warmer than usual, I think, and wind.
And it's good that it doesn't rain in a way because you can control the water, putting the water on the trees.
Yes, that is a point, but rain is always better than irrigation water.
Now, we're talking irrigation water. Last time I spoke to you, it was uncertainty about whether this great southeast irrigation scheme was going ahead. It is, so you're happy with that?
Yes, it runs through this property and we've brought an allowance or put in for an allowance off it, a small allowance, because we already have plenty out of the Craigieburn, but could be better.
And which means you're probably going to put in more trees.
Yes, we're talking about it, putting in a few more thousand this year, maybe.
How many have you got at the moment?
Probably 12 to 14,000, that's what's said, so yeah.
With the olive industry, it's been a tough time with regard to the availability of oil worldwide. What's happening now? What should consumers think? You're going to get a bumper crop. Does that mean the costs will go down to the consumer?
No, the costs will go up again this year.
Really?
Because Europe's had another fairly ordinary year, and I think the demand is increasing year on year because people realise how good of a product is, especially this cold climate olive oil.
Do you have much trouble getting rid of it with the price so high from the consumer point of view?
Well, this year we haven't been able to keep up with it. We're getting down in our stockpile now. Way down. So the sooner we start harvesting, the quicker we'll have oil.
So this year, you'll probably have a bigger crew, will you, to process it all?
Oh, in a town where we're our processing factory. No, it's a 2 to 3 man job in there. It should just be a longer year for them this year.
So this time next year, you'll probably still have a lot more oil than you have this year.
Yes, and it does. The cold climate oil keeps a lot better than the warm climate oil.
Where does it mainly end up? Do you send it interstate?
Some sent interstate, but it's mainly restaurant and boutique stores selling boutique Tasmanian products sell it a lot.
Yep.
The likes of Wicked Cheese in it, Richmond and...
What have the people been telling you, the consumers, with regard to price? It doesn't matter, they'll still buy it?
Well, you can still buy our oil in bulk, say 3 litres, probably only $15 dearer than the supermarket 3 litres, which could be Spanish, it could be Australian.
With the olive industry in the state, is it different to what it was, say, 5-10 years ago? Are more people leaving the industry?
I think there's more trees being abandoned, yes, because people
really
realise how hard a work it is.
Yeah.
Because you just drive around here and there's little groves neglected, which is a bit of a shame, but that's their choice.
So what's the future of the industry in Tasmania when the product is very much desired?
Well, if we plant a few more, I've been in touch with another potential grower this morning, actually, who wants to put in 5 hectares, so that'd be a couple thousand trees, because the manual side of the picking, because we're the only mechanical harvests in the state that I'm aware of, which is easy, but that machine to buy new is probably $300,000-$400,000, which makes it unaffordable for a small lot.
So how do most people go about doing the harvesting, the smaller operators in Tasmania?
Oh, they have vibrating fingers like on the mechanical grape harvesters. They have the, so they're just handheld rakes of those, which you swipe up and down the tree and catch it in a tarp and pick it up, put it into a bin.
And your machine, describe how it operates.
Well, it clamps around the tree with a hydraulic clamp and umbrella hydraulically folds out about 4 metre diameter around the tree. And then you shake the tree with a hydraulic shaker and the olives fall into a half-ton bin, and then you go empty that when it's full into bins.
And off to the processing plant.
Yeah.
How long have you been in the industry now, Chris?
3 years.
How much is there to learn about olives?
I think you'd learn all your life. Like, I think farming in general, it's a learning curve for everybody.
Yeah.
Whether you've been doing it all your life or 3 years.
And you're loving it still?
Yeah, it's good. Good. Apart from this wind today.
Yeah, with the lack of
and
rain.
And no rain.
Oh. It's a familiar song around southern Tasmania and all parts of Tasmania at the moment. How has it been really, you know, when you look at the dry conditions last 12 months, been really bad? You're lucky to have that water?
Yeah, we've been lucky. Like the sheep, we haven't had to feed the sheep yet because there's, 200 merino ewes. But it's been awfully close. But now we've had a little bit of rain in the last couple of weeks. There's just that little tinge of growth around, which is just keeping them going. So we should be right now.
Busy time coming up. Good luck with it.
Thank you.
Yeah, Chris Dick, the manager at least of Tasmanian Olive Groves, largest olive oil producer in the state, talking about the latest harvest at the grove just outside Campania in the Coal River Valley. Well, celebrating 35 years, the Australian Alpaca Association has been using this week to showcase all things alpaca, including farm stays, alpaca meet and greets and fleece workshops. It is National Alpaca Week. Catherine Lloyd is from the EP Cambridge Alpaca Stud in South Australia and has seen the industry grow since first getting involved with alpacas many, many years ago. She says it's a great week to celebrate the animal from farming through to fashion.
Yes, I think all the alpaca industry, especially throughout the rural parts, really enjoy the Alpaca Week and meeting new people and showcasing their animals off as best they can.
How long have you been involved with alpacas?
We first bought our first alpacas back in 1993, so we've been in the industry a very long time.
How much have you seen the industry growing, in particular in South Australia?
It's been quite amazing, actually. The levels, we've got a number of very large commercial studs in South Australia, as well as very competitive throughout the country, actually, in the show rings for the alpacas that are bred in South Australia. So it's very pleasing.
And so in particular with what you do, what are you breeding alpacas for?
Okay, the majority of our breeding is for breeding stock. So we do a lot of showing. We sell a lot of top studs off to other breeders wanting to improve their herds. And we also sell, we export quite a few to China. For instance, we've sent over about 500 to China in the last couple of years. And also then there's also the fleece side of it as well, or the wool, which is really growing at the moment and really doing really wonderful things at the moment with lots of distributors wanting our fibre.
Who is looking for that fibre, that alpaca fleece?
Yeah, there's a number of them. There's a couple of South Australian breeders that are putting groups of or bales together, and then also interstate as well. And we do also have the UK, many from the UK coming out and looking for good fibre as well.
What's the key to a good alpaca fleece?
Low micron is the main thing. So need it to be low micron and even in its micron. So the softness of the wool and the evenness of the wool all over the alpaca. So the more fleece you can use from one alpaca is obviously advantageous.
And you mentioned there about exporting your alpacas. How well is South Australian alpacas seen across the world, or those countries that are buying them in?
South Australia would be one of the leading areas, certainly outside of Peru. And we've sent a lot of animals over the years through into Europe and the UK. And as I said before, I've got a number of studs here that are very, very competitive in the show rings throughout Australia. So we do get many internationals coming sourcing animals from South Australia.
And Catherine, the Australian Alpaca Association is marking 35 years of the alpaca industry in Australia. What sort of events take place during the week?
Mainly, I think from the stud and farm point of view, is a lot of the farms are open to people to visit. We're not specifically open, but we're more than happy to take calls and show people around if they want to make an appointment. And then In August, there's the National Australian Alpaca Association show, which is always a big showcase as well, and that's held in Bendigo, Victoria.
And as part of the celebrations as well, the association is telling people to wear alpaca this winter. Are you finding a lot of Australians know about alpaca fleece as well and using that as a product?
Yes, I certainly the interest in alpaca fibre and purchasing alpaca garments is definitely advanced and getting more and more. And a number of my friends are often asking where they can buy, you know, a nice alpaca jacket or jumper from. And so, yeah, it's very, very exciting for the fibre part of the industry.
People that don't know, what's the difference between an alpaca fleece and sheep wool?
Okay, so there's no prickle factor. So you can wear alpaca against your skin. You shouldn't have any allergic reactions in comparison to sheep. And it's very cashmere-like. It's very, very, very soft to touch.
What about alpaca meat, Catherine? Is that still looking at... I spoke with an alpaca farmer this time last year and they were saying that that's becoming more and more popular. Are you finding that in your part of the world?
Yes, definitely. We don't specifically do the alpaca meat ourselves here at EP Cambridge, but we have sold weather quality or gelding quality males off to the meat part of the industry, which is slowly developing throughout Australia.
And just finally, Catherine, what are you planning to do to celebrate Alpaca Week?
Well, we've got a few clients coming in to have a look around, and we've also got on the Saturday the 17th is the Mount Pleasant show, so we're taking a group of animals to the Mount Pleasant show, so that should be exciting because that was cancelled earlier this year because it was too hot, so they've rescheduled it for the 17th, which works well for the alpaca celebrations for the week.
Just on that, how have you gone with the conditions with the alpacas with this dry weather? Have you been able to get feed and that kind of thing?
Yes, we have. We're quite lucky in that aspect. We've got other properties that we've been able to do our own hay, but I'll be honest, it's starting to get pretty dire now. We really, really need some rain.
Oakbank alpaca farmer Catherine Lloyd speaking there with Brooke Neindorf, and it is National Alpaca Week. More information on the alpaca website. Well, behind every success, there's always a story, and that certainly is proving the case at the National Stockhorse Show in Tamworth. For Gunnedah competitor Barry Moore and his stallion Starwart's Cool Justice, they share a very special story. The pair have taken out the coveted Abbey Open Challenge. Barry told Lara Webster he and Cool Justice have shared a lifetime together.
It's an unbelievable win, especially for this stallion of mine. That he's 17. We've been competing together since he was 2 years old, and you know, he's been in this Abbey Open Challenge many times. He's placed in the top five a couple of times and won different sections at different times. And then yesterday he just produced his best work over four disciplines. And it was just exceptional.
Well, I have no doubts it was. The smile on your face when you're talking about this, there's certainly no doubt a bond after 17 years. I mean, longer than some marriages, isn't it? So, but tell me, I did say there is a story. Every time I come to these events, there's a story behind the horse and the rider. And how they got to where they're going. Talk to me about you and your stallion.
Yeah, so it is a special story. Goes back right into the 90s when we purchased an old mare from Neville and Lynn Holtz. They really looked after us with that mare, and we bred some lovely fillies out of her. And the last one actually was a really unique story because. She wouldn't go back in foal of the same stallion, and this was Ken Brown from Gatherbourne down in Bunnan, and he rang me and he said if you want her back in foal, I've put her with the young stallion up on the hill, the young colt. Anyway, that turned out to be Brown Victory, and he was an amazing horse, and so that's the stallion's mother, and so it's a really hell of a story. So
I imagine you've had many moments over that journey.
Yeah, look, he's just been unbelievable for me. Like, his mother was a great horse as well, and I had sort of my biggest success with her, and then to take it on, you know, and he's just been... his temperament's the main thing, you know. He's at his age, he still just turns up and he can do his work and he doesn't get flustered and anything like that. But, yeah, we've had some big wins. He's won champion working at Sydney Royal three times and he's only been there three times, so... One of them was only just recently, back in April, and then here at the national show, he's won the Supreme Working here, which is another one of the most prestigious wins as well, and won many stallion champion stallion workings as well. So,
you know, 17. It's a good innings too to still be on the circuit, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, and I mean, it's not like he's got a huge workload. Like, he's not a horse that needs a heap of work. You know, we just ride him to keep him maintained, basically, to take him to events when we're going. And, you know, with me being on the board this last 6 years, it's been a little bit sparse too. We haven't gone to as many events, but just this, he hadn't been anywhere for about 18 months, actually, and then last spring I thought he looked amazing, and I thought I really need to take him back out, and he won two open challenges just before Christmas.
That's just showing off, isn't it? He's an old hand.
He was, yeah, so he won a couple of champion workings, and yeah, the two open challenges, and the one up at Narrabri he won three out of the four sections, so... Yeah.
So to win the Abbey Challenge now after all of this time, just how special is that?
It's pretty amazing. Like, you know, he's known as a working horse. That's what his best gig is, and he can work like not many other horses can. But
how so?
Well, his temperament plays a big part, but it's his agility, like. You know, he can gallop into his haunch turns and, you know, turn around and come back out. And he can do his fast work and come back to his slow work. And, yeah, so, it's an exceptional thing. You don't see a lot of horses. A lot of horses can canter in and do a nice haunch turn. But when you're really at that top speed and you're asking them to, without stopping, to get in, engage their hindquarters, change directions and go back the same way they came. It's a really big manoeuvre, and you know, a lot of it's natural ability. You know, you can work pretty hard to try and train that into horses, and you definitely can train it, but you can't help but have that natural ability just takes you a long way.
Yeah, the natural ability it is. 2025 Abbey Open Challenge winner Barry Moore sharing his story of his stallion Star Wars Cool Justice. We'll put a podcast of today's program up for you shortly, and back tomorrow with the Country Hour after midday.